Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is July 25th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Making Christian Sense of Contemporary Popular Music, presented by Peter Mercer Taylor. The number is MEP2005-06. Let's listen in.
Ministries, go ahead and roll them. My name is Peter Mercer Taylor. I am here from the University of Minnesota. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. I teach on the faculty of the School of Music at the University of Minnesota. I was hired as a Mendelssohn scholar, first and foremost, and it's Mendelssohn on whom I have worked more than anybody else. At this moment, though, my teaching is divided about 50-50 between the teaching of classical music and the 19th century tradition and popular music, late 20th century popular music, about half of the classes I teach these days are related to rock in some way or another, and this is becoming an increasingly, the field is taking up an increasingly large share of my research work as well. The things I'm working on at the moment, I've just finished what I hope will be the last piece of Mendelssohn work I ever do, and I'm embarking on more sort of popular music projects. I've written on R.E.M. and the Bangles and Elvis Costello and They Might Be Giants and some other bands that I just happen to be especially fond of. One of my basic rules of thumb, and this is not a rule of thumb that all musicologists live by, is that I really only work on music that I really adore. And this is almost as true of my teaching as it is of my scholarship. I really do try to restrict myself to music in which I find real value. And I tend to find value in a lot of different kinds of music, as I think in this day and age most of us do. That seems to be the sort of current these days. And my students in particular have taught me that we've entered a world in which a kind of radical eclecticism is simply par for the course, that I run across student after student who seems to like just every kind of music under the sun. And it's often easier for a student to name the one or two kinds of music that they don't like. I mean, I have students say, I like everything but country, I like everything but gangster rap, I like everything but whatever. Students will sometimes have one pocket they simply don't care about, but they insist that they care about everything else. And this has been the kind of rule of thumb that has guided my career, that there are all kinds of needs where the sort of musicological community is concerned, and where the musicologist must conceive of his or her own service to an educational institution. And at the same time, I think we're finding new ways all the time of finding value in music that's traditionally been considered valueless, or perhaps of only minimal value. Now, popular music scholarship is not a new thing. There have been serious popular music scholars on the scene since the early 70s, but it certainly is in its boom years right now. There are more and more popular music scholars across the country, all over the world, and it is perhaps the fastest growing branch of the musicological industry in general. This is the perspective I'm coming from. Now that I think we're more or less all in the room, I'll apologize once more for not having nearly enough handouts. We have 30 of the things kind of sprinkled throughout the room, but if you can be within a stone's throw of a handout, you'll find that handy. You don't really need the handout at all. It contains the lyrics of the three songs we'll be talking about today. None of them is all that hard to understand anyhow, so you're not missing anything if you don't have the handouts. But one thing that has tended not to take place where popular music is concerned, at least where the sort of thoroughgoing musicological study of popular music, careful examinations of single specimens of it, of single sort of musical texts, one thing that's been kind of missing is the question of Christianity, the question of religion in general, and what religion and the study of popular music might have to do with one another. There's been some very exciting work done on just kind of the field of popular music in general, and as it stands against or with the Christian community. Various people have undertaken projects of this kind, but specific sort of musicological investigations into how the notes really go, into how these texts really operate, and what this might have to do with the traditional formations as they're understood of Christian thought. This has not really been very seriously undertaken. And in the course of the five conversations that I'll be leading this week, I hope that we can begin the process of undertaking that or further the conversation in the sort of spotty condition in which it stands. Now, one thing I'm not here to do is try to separate the sheep from the goats in some sense. That is to try to figure out what popular music it is that can be deemed acceptable to Christian ears and what cannot be deemed acceptable to Christian ears. I tend to be, although I'm quite stodgy when it comes to church music itself, I really do like traditional hymns and almost nothing else. I'm extremely stodgy on that front. But when it comes to what can be consumed, sort of responsibly consumed by sort of run-of-the-mill Christian folk, I've never understood the value of drawing up lines in any way. If you want to go after sort of Satan's work in the world, you can, I don't know, write a letter to the Secretary of Defense or not shop at Walmart or something like that. But we shouldn't just go after entertainers. The entertainment industry, I think, is the last place, you know, that Satan can really find a good tool to be sort of executing his work in the world. He's more interested in guns and disease and stuff like that. The entertainment industry doesn't need to bother us, I think, as much as we tend to think it probably ought to bother us. But what I am interested in doing, and we can take this out back after the talk too, I'm sure that some of you will disagree with what I just said, but what I am interested in doing is asking the question of what Christianity and popular music might actually have to do with each other. And I might as well get a couple of sort of basic articles of faith on the table where my own relationship to rock is concerned. And it is rock music with which we'll be beginning today, and this, you know, specific kind of popular music, rock music, with which we'll be concerned in several of the conversations in the course of this week. Rock is about resistance. It is about autonomy. It's about rebelliousness. It's about the seizure of power. And in a certain sense, if you are not somehow espousing the process of a kind of radical independence, the development of a radical independence, or the formation of a genuinely rebellious individualism, then the kind of music you're making isn't really rock. That's what it takes to be rock. There has to be some sort of kernel of that resistance there at the heart of the thing, or rock is not what it is. Now, if such a kernel exists, I have a hard time understanding how any specimen of music can be described as Christian music, which is to say, this is something that Christian music really cannot be about in order to be, I think, responsible Christian music. It cannot be about rebelliousness, it cannot be about the bucking of tradition, or at least it can be about those things in a kind of conditional sense or a carefully contained sense. But in short, rock music and Christian music had this kind of wall between them in my own mind that really is, in a certain sense, a kind of impermeable wall, that for my money, there really is not such a thing as purely Christian, pure rock. That is, it can't be purely both of those things. I think there is Christian rock in certain terms, but it can't really be a pure specimen of both Christian music and rock. I don't think Christian music and rock necessarily have all that much to do with each other. But we can take that one up too. But if you're walking around in the woods and a bear starts chasing you, we can presume that the bear is chasing you for different reasons than, say, a mountain lion is chasing you. The bear is going to see you as a threat to its territory, perhaps a threat to its sort of personal being. A bear is not going to see you as food. Bears just don't hunt 150-pound mammals. That's not what they do for food. So that's not what a bear is doing chasing you. But if the next day you go out and a mountain lion starts chasing you, well, the mountain lion probably is chasing you for food. The mountain lion sort of thinks, well, that's an interesting looking deer. Let's go for it. And the mountain lion can chase you with the plan to eat you. Mountain lions and bears will chase you for different reasons. Yet the experience of being chased by a bear and a mountain lion may add up to something pretty similar in your own mind. That is, if you're chased by one, there will be the same kinds of thing involved, the same running, screaming, sort of new sense of humility before the greatness of God's creation. And this is how I feel, I guess, about music, is that rock music and Christian music aren't the same thing, in my mind can't be the same thing, yet our responses to them can be similar. And if we actually think about the kinds of responses they're drawing forth, the kinds of things they're inviting us to kind of work our way through as human beings making our way through the world, in fact, there can be similarities there. And they can push us in similar directions. Tonight we're going to take a very narrow slice of the sort of whole history of popular music in the late 20th century, indeed of the whole history of rock. We're taking a very narrow chunk of that, diving into one of my very favorite eras of rock, the mid-70s era of arena rock. This is a word that turned up in my title and probably baffled many of you in the room if you're not sort of rock aficionados. What is arena rock? Well, the rock industry had arrived at a point by the early 70s at which the Beatles had made it clear with concerts in Shea Stadium and so on that you actually could get a stadium full of people. You actually could get a stadium full of people at a rock concert. And the industry began to develop itself to sort of chart its course toward the creation of sort of superhero rock stars. Rock stars who really could fill an arena's worth of people. 20,000 people coming to a single rock concert. And the industry sort of realized, the record companies realized that this is how it really needed to work in order for them to make money. You had to propel superstars, just a few of them at a time, but you had to develop superstars who could fill an arena with sound, fill an arena with kids, and create a sound that seemed to be worth the price of a ticket and the price of sitting 70 rows back and so forth. You had to develop a sound big enough to accomplish this. And in the mid-70s, many different bands took many different approaches to doing just this. Rock had, in a certain sense, passed its age of innocence. People were beginning already to tell sort of golden age myths about rock music, saying, oh yeah, well, back in the 60s, we had the Beatles, the Rolling Stones were at their prime, Bob Dylan was just coming out of the starting gate. You know, those were the good old days. Here in the 70s, we're kind of looking back on that.
Simon and Garfunkel.
That's right, Simon and Garfunkel. The whole scene was changing and changing fast. We'll be talking about Paul Simon in 4 days, too. But the scene was changing fast in the 60s, and in the 70s, there was this kind of retrospective air to the whole thing. That people were looking back on rock, saying to themselves, you know, that was really it. That was the golden age of rock. And, you know, what we're doing now is kind of looking back on that, trying to assess the value of that. Rock had begun to tell sort of self-mythologizing stories about itself. And at least two of the three songs that we're listening to today really are songs about music. And this is no coincidence. They're songs about music and how it's to be consumed and the kind of power that it can have in your life. This is not true of the first song, but true of the next two. And this is a very important principle. What people valued in rock, and the way that these mythologies began to develop themselves, was around the idea that rock music, and this still is very much true of rock today. If you look it up in the Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians, the greatest sort of music dictionary there is, the definition of rock, it will be described in terms of its authenticity, in terms of its truth. That rock is believed to be a form of music that has access to certain kinds of truthfulness, to a certain kind of core meaning to which popular music in general does not. That rock is true. Rock is authentic. And the kinds of truth that rock has access to, no other art form has access to. We can't really put our fingers on them, but when we can look at a band like Led Zeppelin, a band like the Beatles, a band like whoever, we get the sense that what they created could not have been created in any other genre, could not have been created in any other medium. It may be hard for us to say precisely what has been communicated, but the thing communicated is truth. It is authentically itself, and it's the sort of wonderful thing that has made the world bigger by its very existence. And that's what the mid-70s songs tended to be about, was this sense of the manufacturing of truth, the manufacturing of a kind of higher reality, of an art form that sort of pulls us out of the ordinary. And we begin to approach with this kind of language what I'm trying to get at in the conversation today. That no, none of the three songs we're talking about today, none of the songs we're listening to at any point in these conversations this week, mentions Jesus, not a single one of them. These are not Christian songs. Yet, all three of the songs we're listening to today have ways of resisting the world as it stands. All three of the songs cast a skeptical eye toward accepting the world as it is, toward the belief that that you know all that really has value can be found in the world as we find it. These songs are skeptical. These songs are saying, no, we have to work beyond the world as we find it. We have to put our faith in things that can't simply be grasped in the world around us. We have to have hope for a better future. We have to have a belief in a kind of redemptive gesture of one kind or another in the future at some point. Now, none of this is described in Christian language, but it's all right there. This sense of the possibility of redemption. And rock's own kind of redemptive self-mythology, the sense that there was something just fundamentally redemptive about this art form, figures very powerfully in the formation of conversations like this within the rock songs themselves. I want to begin with Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. I teach this course on rock, and my students always laugh for some reason when I make the following confession to them. But if I had to pick the number one rock song of all time, Bruce Springsteen is not my favorite artist by any means. I think he's terrific. He's not my favorite rock artist. But I believe he did record the number one rock song of all time. If anybody ever entrusted me with the list, I'd say this is it. This is the best rock song ever recorded. And I don't know how many of you in the room have ever heard this song in your lives. Quick show of hands. Actually, I want a show of hands for people who think they have never heard Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. Okay, well, some of us have perhaps not. I believe this is the best rock song ever recorded. Bruce Springsteen had slammed out of the starting gate about 3 years before this album, Born to Run, was recorded in 1975. He was sort of riding on the heels of Bob Dylan. His first work was highly sort of poetic, seriously poetic stuff with way too many words, a little bit too little music, still exceedingly catchy stuff, and some wonderful songs even on his first albums. But it was with this album that I think he really got his feet under him and became the consummate master that he is. What intrigues me about Born to Run is the way in which it seems to encapsulate in such a pure sense existing mythologies at this point about what rock was capable of. It's a redemptive story. And I want to begin here just by listening to the first verse of this song and talk a little about what we've heard by the time we get to the end of the first verse. And then we'll sort of make our way through verses two, then what we call the break or the middle eight, make our way through verse two, the break, and into verse three. But let's listen to the first verse and talk about what we've got so far. What's it about lyrically? What's it about musically? What grabs you so far?
Upbeat.
It is extremely upbeat.
It's the beat.
Yeah,
it is the beat. The song, the words don't have to be there.
Yeah. There's this motoric driving beat. And I gotta say, when I was just sort of queuing up the CD before this class, turning it on, just to kind of be sure there was noise coming out, I turned it on and thought, oh my gosh, I messed this up. I brought Little Eva's The Locomotion instead. Because that's what the first bars of this thing sound like. And I don't know how many of you know The Locomotion, but it sounds exactly like this. This sort of grinding sort of train of a sound. And The Locomotion was intended to sound like a train, and this does too. It sounds motoric, for goodness sake. I mean, it sounds like this sort of giant machine sort of throbbing along with a life force throbbing along over it. I mean, the way that these, with that pounding away and the way that that sort of counter melody, the little melody springs to life, it's as though we have this driving machine, but also the incursion of life. This thing sort of has this spark in it, this ghost in the machine drives the whole thing forward. Other thoughts as the verse unfolds. How does this thing work?
Yeah. That feeling of young, we've got to get out of here.
Yeah.
You know, to paraphrase another song,
but
we need to get out of here because this isn't for us. There's something wrong with what we're seeing.
Good. And it's described in geographic terms, which is to say there's this town and we need to move ourselves from here to anywhere else. But obviously this is just kind of a geographic mapping of the entire youth experience, what it means to be young. Here's adulthood, here's this other place. And I don't know where it is, but we don't want to be adults, that much we know. And in this sense, there's this kind of symbolic link between being young and being sort of old and adult and stodgy and stuck in this town. And it's a metaphor, a very powerful sort of geographic metaphor, yes.
And so for me, when I was looking at the lyrics though, and I was trying, I was thinking of the I mean, I was moving from downtown. I'm thinking, what the heck is he talking about? And I know that moving out, Anthony's song is the same concept as Billy Joel.
Absolutely, right. And Billy Joel's, got exactly the same story to tell. And in that case, it isn't just geographic stuff. It's things like occupations. Billy Joel's song about this guy's got this job, he's quitting it. This guy's got that job, he's a fool. This guy's got that job, he ought to quit. It's sort of moving out of a job. But this is Billy Joel's story, but moving out is still a language. Yes?
There's a theme of transgression and risk, suicide machines. But you're going to die in a different way if you stay.
Absolutely, because this town's a death trap, too. It's death one way or the other. Stay in the death trap or get on the suicide machine and ride. Yeah, and they're both about death. Yeah.
Isn't it an escape from class?
Great.
That's when I hear this is a story of working class people trying to escape their class. I mean, and I remember that from the first time I heard it when I was 13.
You know, I had the weirdest feeling I knew this song. I had never heard this before. You're right. You're absolutely right. Yes. And there's something about Bruce Springsteen and the way that he is able to sort of crystallize in the language of rock the issue of class, just the issue of what it is to be a member of the working class, especially through the Vietnam era. So many Bruce Springsteen songs seem to find us just kind of sitting around this formica kitchen table, you know, with one member of the family all fighting the Viet Cong, everybody else just sort of scrabbling by. This is music about class, and that's a very interesting observation, that as much as it's about geography, as much as it's about youth culture, it is about class.
I've never heard this before, the song, and I'm not following the cars and the road. There are all these car references and streets and roads.
Right.
And is that external thing, or is that part of what we are, or I'm not them?
Luckily, somebody in the room has a great answer, and it's her.
That's the classic connection when you're young. Your car is the only place you can get away from your parents and be free.
Right.
I mean, that it gets you somewhere else.
Yep. Be free to drive, be free to not drive, whatever. Cars are a place to do all kinds of stuff. Right. But this idea of just being in motion, I respectfully submit that the song can be understood as one great pun on the notion the quick and the dead. We're quickened in the sense that we want to be those folks who are quick. We want to be those folks who are moving, as opposed to those folks who are stationary, who are dead. And that much we have to believe in our ability to get at somehow. Now, what's happening musically? Let's get to the music for a moment. What has Bruce Springsteen accomplished? By the way, he's being propelled along here by the E Street Band. Now, they're just unsafe at any speed. This is just a very loud band, and they just sound loud no matter what. Bruce Springsteen, for those of you who've ever seen him, at least in his sort of earlier days, most bands have an opening act that'll come out and play a set, 6-8 song set, and then they will come out and play perhaps 45 minutes, maybe an hour. Bruce Springsteen doesn't have opening bands, and he plays for 4 hours. He just sort of stands up, and the band gets going, and they play 4 hours. That's right, and it's just incredible. And the way that he thrashes around with his voice every night, and that he can stand up 2 nights later and do it again, it is simply amazing, just an athletic feat. He's terrific. But what has he accomplished musically here? Obviously, the sound itself is overpowering. And yes, the sort of grinding groove that we get into at the beginning does feel very motoric, feels very propulsive, gives us that sense of motion right out of the starting gate. What else? What about the melody? What does it do? I'm sorry.
Let us hear it again.
Yeah, well, we should. Let's hear the second verse. You know what we've got. Certain notes, not other notes. Why does he pick the notes he picks?
as analog.
As what? I'm sorry.
That song is totally analog. I mean, they take an original record,
yeah,
and they put on a put onto CD.
Yes. Yeah.
And I can definitely tell when this is a CD that the length that misses what the needle picks up with the
the laser and
the record's design, but the laser doesn't pick that up
quickly. Yeah. Well, as far as I'm concerned, everything's better in analog. We can.
You can translate this into the right terminology, but it has kind of a long arc. It takes a long time to resolve.
Yes, it does. And does it sort of move down or does it sort of move up? What can we say about this?
Move up.
Up. It moves up. I mean, that is that we. And if we sort of parse it up phrase by phrase, oh, look here, we end. That is, the highest note we get in that phrase is this. We're in the key of E, there's an A. The second phrase. Well, that's how the second phrase, or the second verse goes. That's how the first verse goes. We get as high as this note. And with the sort of bridge into the chorus, we get this. We sort of hammer away at this note, but we get this high in the first line, we get this high in the second line, we get this high in the sort of bridge into the chorus, and then we get this scream, you know, without any words at all up on that G. That is that every phrase gives us another high note. This is a song about escape, and it's a song musically about escape as much as it's a song lyrically about escape. It's a song about establishing a kind of pitch ceiling, then transcending that pitch ceiling. Now, as it happens, I won't get into the sort of nitty-gritty of this, but he throws in this note in the second chorus that he did not have in the first chorus. Instead of simply going, baby, this town rips the bones from your back, it's a death trap, it's a suicide rap, we gotta get out while we're young. That's how the first chorus goes. The second chorus, will you walk with me out on the wire? 'Cause baby, I'm just a scared and lonely rider, and I gotta know how it feels. But this G sharp that he has up here, we have never heard a note that high before. This is the highest note of the song so far, with this word baby. Baby, I'm just a scared and lonely writer. He's trying out this new thing in the middle of the chorus. He throws it out, the highest note we've heard yet, G sharp. Keep your eye on that G sharp, it becomes exceedingly important. I want to press on because we have Boston and Aerosmith coming. We probably won't get to them both, but we'll sort of give them a try.
Boston, Aerosmith.
We'll see how it goes. But we're going to dive into what we call the middle lane.
Bridge.
Bridge is probably a better term for it, bridge or break. We'll call it a bridge. That is this thing that breaks away from verses and choruses and takes us to another place. And it is here that Bruce Springsteen finally lays on the line what I submit is perhaps the kind of dominant the dominant myth underlying the musical structure of this song, and that is a death and redemption myth. We have to pass through death. It's true that both of our options spell death. We've got a suicide machine out in the driveway, we've got this death trap of a town that we live in. They're both about death. How do we ever get past death? Well, the words can't explain it. The words don't have access to this sort of language. What lies beyond death? I mean, got to get away, and it's got to spell passing through death. How do we do it?
Sex.
We can't do it lyrically. Sex, perhaps, and he gets to that in other songs more explicitly than this one. But in this case, it's the music that gets the job done. The music features the winding down of everything. And he tells this incredibly touching middle eight where the poetry sneaks up on you. If you're really paying attention as it gets into the bridge here, beyond the palace, hemi-powered drones scream down the boulevard, the girls comb their hair in rearview mirrors and the boys try to look so hard. And then this imagery, the amusement park rises bold and stark, kids are huddled on the beach in a mist. And there they are in this sort of border territory. Beaches are always this way. It's a place where worlds meet. And the kids are out there, and there's this mist, as though the sort of water is already infesting the dry land somehow. And it's a very beautiful image. The kids are huddled on the mist. It's not pleasant. This isn't a pretty thing. Kids are huddled out there, sort of trying to live this down. And where this bridge finally goes is to a great collapse in which every note of the scale. And this is where the bridge leaves us, is with death, with motionlessness. And it's a very sad moment. And you might, if you didn't have the lyric sheet in front of you, you might actually suspect for a moment, well, that's kind kind of a dumb ending, but that's the end. That's how the song kind of winds down. That's right, and it sounds as though things have just kind of wrapped themselves up. And then Bruce Springsteen, by sheer dint of will, screams 1, 2, 3, 4, and the band kicks in again, and the third verse comes. There are men of a certain generation. I'm of that generation, and there are not many of us in this room, some older, some younger, and you shouldn't laugh at us, but there are men of this generation who can't listen to this song without getting genuinely sort of tight-throated and misty-eyed. This is an incredibly moving thing when this last verse comes along. And what's neatest about the last verse, perhaps, is that he has thrown caution to the wind, and he does not return to the melody that he had in the first verse. He returns to a melody that begins with that G sharp, the very highest note he's given us so far. The highway's jammed with broken heroes on a last chance powered drive. Everybody's out on the road tonight. He's rewritten the melody such that that place that we finally kind of burst tentatively through the ceiling, through the pitch ceiling of the piece, becomes our home. This is the place we're going to inhabit. This is where the last verse will take place, he tells us. So we've passed through death into this sort of higher form of life. Let's give it a listen. Concerned. But obviously for me, one of the most sort of viscerally challenging or exciting parts of the song is the way in which he just refuses to let music and words agree, that somehow his subjectivity, sort of his selfhood, resides in these words that he's trying to get out. And not even the music itself wants him to get it out. The music itself doesn't want him to give enough room as he's there, someday, girl, I don't know when, we're going to get to that place where we really want to go and we'll walk in the sun. There's not nearly enough notes in there for him to say this thing. He just crams him in because he's just going to do it. He's just going to get out of this thing. And, you know, no matter how long it takes, no matter how badly the syllables go, he's just going to get this out. And it's just an amazing, it's a very forceful moment. Yeah.
And that's on the bridge, and then that's also on the last part that run the bridge and bridge tree. And notice that before the 1, 2, 3, and as he's losing his voice on the bridge and us on the third verse, he's losing his voice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can sort of feel the whole thing deteriorating, the whole machinery begin to sort of break down on him as he goes. That's a terrific effect. Other thoughts about this thing?
What it does for me is it speaks of victory through, you know, no matter what has happened, like, he's won, you know, the team is not lost, everything is just right there as it should be.
Yeah. Now, is that Christianity or is that the opposite of Christianity? This sort of triumph. I mean, what is a Christian supposed to do with this sort of victory, with this sort of death and resurrection myth that a rock song puts forward? There's an easy question.
Not to change your... It's less the victory, death, resurrection. It's more of just the promise is what I hear. It's just the promise is at the end.
Great.
And that's where it aligns with...
Yeah.
You know, last verse with that of hope.
Yeah. Terrific.
And I mean, he's taken you through 5 years on a motorcycle, dropped you down one, and then he slams you right back in. Yeah. And that message of redemption and hope.
Terrific. Yes. And at no point do the words say we got there. He's still saying, I don't know when. I don't know when we're going to get to that place. But it's out there. And yes, it's a message of hope. And in spite of everything, in spite of anything like common sense, we're going to continue hoping that this will happen. It sounds silly even as he's saying it. We're going to walk in the sun. I mean, this is dumb. But still he insists. We're going to get to that place where we really want to go. Let's move on. Speaking of places we really want to go, quick show of hands. Do we do Boston or Aerosmith first? Who wants to go first to Boston?
Boston!
Okay. Who first to Aerosmith? I think Boston wins. Let's listen to Boston's More Than a Feeling. Boston emerged at this same moment, of course, that Bruce Springsteen emerged here in 1976. Boston was headed by a guitarist-songwriter who actually had an MIT degree in electrical engineering and personally developed much of the technology behind the sound. It was a band for whom the technology of the sound was exceedingly important. And although we think of them as a basically guitar-driven band, in fact, just the technology that went into the recording and especially into the live productions themselves of this guitar-driven band was exceedingly complex. And in fact, the way in which the engineering itself, the design of the sound itself, the way that that contributes to the message the band seems to be trying to get across here turns out to be a very powerful part of the story, at least at one particular moment that I hope we have a chance to dwell on. Again, I want to listen to the first verse and just kind of ask ourselves where we feel like we've gotten by the end of the first verse, what we feel like the great sort of operative forces are in this piece, what's kind of driving things, what the foundational tensions are. Let's give the first verse a listen.
I thought, and the Beatles, and I thought it's mono, as in only one speaker, but not just in the DVD, it actually is two speakers on stereo.
Right.
But this is DVDs that are so unusual how they're taking a lot of records and they're trying to put those onto CD for the
R3. Yep. And the technology is developing fast. I mean, in 1967, the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the first great art rock album, really, was recorded on a four-track machine. That is, they only had four tracks. By the time Boston comes along, they're using 64 or 128 or something. The technology is moving fast. Let's hear what they did with it. This, by the way, is a real fade-in. This is the first song on the first Boston album. It's an acoustic guitar fading in. Already we have this kind of weird marriage of technology and the old-fashioned. We're going to listen to it again without the voiceover. I'll just play it.
Take two.
Here we go.
Take three. Thank you.
with this song? I mean, what's the song about lyrically? What's the song about musically? Where is it going? What have we got so far? I mean, lyrically, we don't have much. I mean, if you look at these things, Bruce Springsteen's giving us poetry. He's got kids huddled in the mist on the beach. There's not a whole lot here. This guy wakes up, he turns on some music, he thinks about this girl named Marianne. I mean,
Marianne, my friend, after high school days, that's a big case. Yeah. The other song I'm talking about is Goodbye Earl. That's the funniest song. Yeah.
And here we have Marianne, and all she does in the song is walk away. We don't have much. I looked out this morning and the sun was gone. Turned on some music to start my day. And what is the song about? Well, the song is about, for some reason, the song being gone, sun being gone, and what that might mean when we can come to. Life is depressing, he turns on music, and what happens when the chorus comes along? Well, it's almost as though, in the last conversation about hymns that we had here last week, I was here last week talking about hymnody, and in our last conversation there, we talked about moments like alleluias, moments where you actually bust into song in the middle of a hymn, that most hymns aren't actually supposed to be songs. I mean, they're just words that happen to be sung. Yet there are moments where you say, and now the angels are singing, glory to God in the highest, and you actually have to sort of imitate the angels singing this song by singing the song. And it's as though this is what's happening in this, chorus. That we're actually having a real live sounding of this song that he sort of turns on the radio and plays, or something like that. I mean, this is music about music. It's music in which the creation of song is sort of enfolded into the development of the song itself. And obviously, the most important break in what we've just heard has to do with that transition from that big, beefy 12-string guitar acoustic sound that we go into the verse with to the moment where the electric guitars come in and we really start rocking out. And we finally get one of these great sort of four-chord grinds. Still listening to popular music, or who are still listening to popular music in 1992, will no doubt know Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. And obviously, Smells Like Teen Spirit is built around a four-chord progression that shows us just how far we have not come. It's a small leap from And obviously, this sort of grinding four-chord sound that Boston gives us in the course of this song is still very much with it today. It's sort of dominant trope of grunge music to this day, of grunge rock. So what happens here? What do you all get out of this song? I mean, are we ready to meditate yet, or should we keep listening? Let's keep listening. Okay, we'll sort of force our way through the whole thing, but here's what I want you to sort of pay attention to. It's just what the guitar is doing. That is, we break for a guitar solo after the second verse, and that's nice. It's a nice guitar solo with its own chord progression, and that's wonderful. But the moment of magic appears to come as we're working our way from the last verse into the last chorus. And I dream of a girl I used to know. I closed my eyes and she slipped away. And we have this idea that we're just about to get into the chorus, but instead he repeats this line, I slipped away. He sings it incredibly high. And all at once, we can't tell whether it's a guitar that we're listening to or a human voice. And the voice just sort of disappears into the stratosphere and bleeds effortlessly into the sound of the electric guitar. And then off goes the guitar solo. And we sort of think, well, that's a cool effect. And then we sort of think again, you know, he's become subsumed somehow into this song that he was talking about. He spent this whole time talking about the experience of listening to a rock song, and now he has turned into this song. This kind of weird transubstantiation has taken place, and suddenly the human being has been enfolded with this song and with his love for this song. And in a certain sense, this seems to be a song about the project of getting over Marianne's departure. Marianne is not a very interesting character. She's not especially well developed. All she does is leave. And the question is, what is this guy going to do to get over Marianne? And the answer is, the music is going to do it for him. What do we do in the face of sort of human loss? What do we do in the face of human suffering of this kind? The emotional suffering involving the loss, the departure of a loved one. Well, in this case, we can at least turn to music, and music is better than that. Music is capable of letting us rise above it, and at the end of the day, the promise is that we will somehow become so at one with the music that we'll be indistinguishable from it.
And also, that same year that this song came out is the same year that Harry Chapin did Ghost Stays Live. Yeah. But so for me, that's a 4-acre set that my uncle, I don't remember my uncle's name, but my dad's brother has a 4-acre set. Yeah. But what they did with that 4-acre set, they made a 12-disc CD from that original record set.
Right. Right. And I wish we had time to listen to Harry Chapin in the course of this week, which we don't, but it's terrific. Also, the same year that Kiss Destroyer came out. Let's give this a listen from Where We Got Off the Bus, and watch the way that the song appears to be first about him sort of turning from this memory toward music, this sort of grinding rock music, being called back at the moment he remembers Marianne, but then finally escaping from this memory of Marianne into the rock. And at his final mention in the entire song of Marianne, the groove refuses to stop. That is, he goes through his "I see my Marianne walking away" that line again, but the guitars don't shut up. They keep sort of grinding on with their little four-chord idea. You'll hear what I mean when we get there. Kind of human loss can be overcome if we simply remember that song that we used to know, if we remember the good old days of rock and how it used to be and the power that music used to have. And here it is again reborn, and here it is in the chorus, music that has that same force, that same power and promise of what may finally add up to something like redemption. Yeah.
And I was in the bridge part when I was in that bit there, and I was like, it is the same guitar sound Can I think of the sound I have that see at home? It's the same sound it is on Taxi.
Okay, which I don't know very well, but okay, great.
Doesn't that thing of old music we know really well, that's etched into us somehow, really transcend genres?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it takes us someplace else.
Yeah.
Sometime else.
Yeah, you can go back to a smell sometimes with the right music, you know?
Yep, yep.
From your childhood, it's amazing what it can bring back.
Right, absolutely.
That's why we love old hymns, right?
That's why we love old hymns, perhaps. That's why I love old hymns. I'm not sure everybody does love old hymns. But, absolutely.
No, I usually play this.
But it's true. I mean, this idea that we should be getting sentimental for this music, that this is rock in the process of manufacturing its own golden age myth. Isn't this how you felt about this music, this rock song is saying? Isn't this what you're doing with this product? And it is a product. It's still a product. These are entertainers trying to peddle their wares, trying to create a certain kind of memory of rock, a certain sense of what rock's power really is. Other closing thoughts? Yeah.
Out of curiosity, Anna, I don't find this song at all lyric-driven. And this is probably the first time I've ever looked at the lyric.
Yeah.
Because the guitar solos, the bass keeps me in it, and the guitar solos when he runs that up with his voice is, that's there. The lyrics are just.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of the music that gives you the hope in this one.
I agree.
Not the lyrics.
Yeah, I agree. And there really is something sort of transcendently triumphant about just what is accomplished here with the music. I mean, I knew this, I've known this song by heart for a long time, but if you ask me what it's about, I don't know, I couldn't really answer it until someone asked. I mean, it's not about much of anything.
You're talking about the individualism versus the community and all. Isn't he trying to kind of create a community that it's what it shares is the old songs and the music and sort of drawing into that, that community?
That's a great thought, right. I think so. And this idea that there's a community of sort of the old guard, I mean, a community built around listening patterns and so on, and that this community has to sort of foster self-awareness of a kind. That's a very good call. Others? Mark, have you got a watch on? How much time do we have?
I have 5 minutes.
5 minutes. That's not long. Listen to Aerosmith. Okay, let's listen to Aerosmith. And you know what? We're going to take 7 minutes because I'm going to take 60 seconds to tell you what to listen for. What's interesting to me about this Aerosmith song is the way in which you have to face two different kinds of dissent. And to me, we're talking about when the lyrics do the work, when the music does the work. Here, the chords are doing the work. And it's a fun thing for musicologists, not much fun for the rest of us, but listen hard, and I think it's a good idea. But the whole song is built around this riff. And so on. And what we have at the center of this is this chromatically descending, snaky bass line. This sort of tragic, chromatic descent. And what this has to be traded in for is this sort of bass line, where the chromaticism of the descent has been exchanged for big, forceful, sort of heavy metal sounding things that come along when he gets into a sort of sing it with me part. And it's as though we're being given an alternative to the tragedy of that descent. But the real alternative finally comes at the moment that he hatches his grand scheme, inarticulate though it is, it's two words long, dream on. And when he gets to this word, dream on, we finally get the song's first true alternative to any kind of descent, which is a grand rising bass line. We hear that twice, and then finally we hear it writ large. We spend the whole song waiting for this thing that happens when he finally gets to these words, dream on, and it happens in the bass line. And it's a building up. It's a final sort of rising answer to everything that had fallen before. Listen, see what you make of it, we'll talk afterwards. This is a live recording, by the way, from about 28 years after the song was first recorded.
Thank you very much.
where it's finally the bass guitarist who's doing the heavy lifting. It's a song about the bass guitarist's journey toward a rising bass line. Instead of the descending bass lines he's been working out so hard, and at last redemption takes place. At the moment we can simply affirm, senseless though it seems, dream on. Thank you very much. Hope to see many of you tomorrow.